Tikal with happiness, for the changes necessary to establish harmonious physical relationships must first descend from the rational sphere and come into physical manifestation through minds specially trained in philosophic procedure. Every child that is born is a potential instrument for the salvation of the world, and remains an unknown but all-powerful quantity. Until our physical-cultural processes destroy those sensitive instruments of erudition by which the imperceptible verities of the rational sphere can be sensed, humanity's most precious assets are those developing physical brains, which as focal centers of mental energy radiate thought throughout the sub-stances of the inferior sphere. The answer to every problem, therefore, must be considered as existing in the rational sphere, awaiting that day when unfolding human brains shall be so disciplined in the procedures of rational thought as to become adequate vehicles for the manifestation of this superior null edge in the physical world, rendered prophetic by the luminosity of their inner natures. The sages of antiquity discoursed with rare acumen upon the fate of the sacred sciences at the hands of generations then unborn. In the Asclepian dialogue is preserved a prophetic picture of the decadence of knowledge in baser ages to come. In those days no one shall look up to heaven. The religious man shall be accounted insane, the irreligious shall be thought wise, the furious brave, and the worst of men shall be considered a good man. For the soul, and all things about it, by which it is either naturally immortal, or conceives that it shall attain to immortality, conformably to what I have explained to you, shall not only be the subject of laughter, but shall be considered as vanity. Believe me, likewise, that a capital punishment shall be appointed for him who applies himself to the religion of intellect. New statutes and new laws shall be established, and nothing religious, or which is worthy of heaven or celestial concerns, shall be heard, or believed by the mind. There will be a lamentable departure of the gods from men, noxious angels will alone remain, who, being mingled with human nature, will violently impel the symbolism, the universal language 349. Miserable men of that time to war, to rapine, to fraud, and to everything contrary to the nature of the soul. Much of this prophecy has already been verified, for during the Dark Ages capital punishment was meted out to those who dared apply themselves to the religion of intellect. Philosophy was swept from the face of Christendom and the voices of the gods were drowned out by the hymns of the martyrs. Fleeing before theological fanaticism, the custodians of the Arcana Imperii took refuge in the Arabian desert, finding Islam more receptive to philosophic instruction. Accepting Greek philosophy as a sacred trust, the sons of the Prophet, when carried into southern Europe on the high tides of their fortunes, established in Spain universities far excelling contemporary Christian institutions of learning. To the colleges of the Moors came scholars from every part of Europe, and the lips of men again taught the inspired doctrines of Plato and Aristotle. Islam realized that the teachings of Plato and his illustrious disciple assisted man to liberate his soul from the entanglements of idolatry, for the four caliphs had set for themselves the task of exterminating idolatry from the earth. Proclus declares that the philosophy of Plato was given to men for the benefit of their terrestrial souls, that philosophy might be authority instead of statutes, rationality instead of temples, understanding instead of sacred institutions, truth instead of mortal leaders of salvation, that the men who are now, as well as those who shall exist hereafter, might not wander about the earth destitute of intelligence. The literalist is an inveterate profaner of the beautiful. His attitude is a supreme blasphemy, for his art is to limit all natures to the narrow confines of form. He sees nothing beyond an appearance, mistaking the outward show for the inner quality and the dimensional as the only certainty. Whereas the idealist ever strives to elevate man to the estate of gods, the literalist would drag the immortals from their Olympian heights and debase them with the similitude of man. The literalist emphasizes inconsequentials, to him every jot and tittle is a fetish. To the literalist, symbolism is inscrutable. 350 lectures on ancient philosophy. He is incapable of distinguishing between principle as an abstract reality and form as the transitory vehicle of that principle. Religious stagnation is the wayward child of literalism. As long as theology clings to the blasphemous idea that to think is to usurp a divine prerogative, theologians are restrained from reasoning on the logic of the law, and only the saints are accredited with sufficient sanctity to contemplate the sandal thongs of the Lord. Quaking under their cowls, the pious clergy read and reread the ominous lines from Revelation, wherein it is written, "If any man shall add unto these things, God shall add unto him the plagues that are written in this book." Little wonder that the divine science of interpretation failed amid such hostile environment, that symbols became fearful images of literal terrors and the gods came to have as many hairs in their beards as some inspired artisan might carve into their Carrara features. Maimonides, the most learned of the rabbins, who devoted a lifetime to contemplation of the scriptures, writes thus of its hidden meanings and secret imports: "We should not take literally that which is written in the book of the creation, Genesis, nor entertain the same concepts of it as are common with the vulgar. If it were otherwise, our learned ancient sages would not have taken so much pains to conceal the sense and to keep before the eyes of the uninstructed the veil of allegory which conceals the truths which it contains." Taken literally, the work contains the most extravagant and absurd ideas of the deity. Whoever can guess at the true meaning should see care not to divulge it. This is a maxim inculcated by our wise men, especially in connection with the work of the 6 days. It is possible that by our own intelligence, or by the aid of others, some may guess the true meaning, in which case they should be silent respecting it, or, if they do speak of it, they should do so obscurely, as I myself do, leaving the rest to be guessed at by those who have sufficient ability to understand me. While the literalist may believe he is defending the integrity of the gods, he is actually detracting from their magnificence by presuming them to be speakers of words when in reality symbolism, the universal language. 351. 352 lectures on ancient philosophy. They are disseminators of ideas. Origen asks, "What man of good sense will ever persuade himself that there has been a first, a second, and a third day, and that these days have each of them had their morning and their evening, when there was as yet neither sun, nor moon, nor stars?" Even the great St. Augustine admitted the scriptures to possess profound and unsuspected meanings, at the same time maintaining with characteristic inconsistency that both their literal and historical accuracy also should be affirmed. We shall yet realize that man cannot live by history alone, even though that history be declared sacrosanct to studious Christian and pagan alike. Symbolism becomes a philosophic stone whereby literal absurdities are transmuted into allegorical realities. While little minds may thus thread their way through religion, those of greater vision recognizing in symbolism a golden key to the treasure house of the world's thought studiously apply themselves to the principles according to which all fables, allegories, and emblematic figures are erected. Another phase of symbolism presents itself for consideration. The literalities of one generation become the allegories of the next. The changing customs, the periodic redirectionalizing of interest, and the reinterpretation of the meanings of words and figures, make it most difficult for any generation to understand its forebears. Hence, to interpret the ideals of one century in the terms of another is to lose a certain intangible atmosphere which cannot survive the vicissitudes of time. Consequently, to secure an accurate translation of Greek philosophic writing does not necessarily imply that we possess the information embodied in those writings. It has been said that no philosophy can survive translation. For no sacred teaching can ever be actually understood except by one able to transport himself into the locale and time in which the material was originally indited. Hence arose the practice of perpetuating the inner doctrines through oral tradition, for it was presumed that each generation would reclothe these basic ideas with proper vestments and thus preserve them free from distortion at the hands of time. To understand the mysteries, we must cease to live in America of the 20th century and assume the temperaments, attitudes, interests, and environments in which the mysteries were first established. To understand Greek philosophy, we must understand ancient Greece and its people. The secret teachings are always clothed in the terms of the familiar when revealed to the multitudes, and the familiar terms of yesterday are not the familiar terms of today. The same is true of the Bible. The archaic Hebrew of the pre-Christian period interpreted the ideals of an older people of whom not one true vestige now remains. The Pentateuch is the living remnant of a world long dead, of interests which have outlived their time, of attitudes archaic, and ethics extinct. If we would release the spirit of beauty locked within the ancient characters and make it serve this generation, we must divest it of its ancient robes and reclothe it in the familiar habiliments of today. With rare discrimination we must separate the principle from its form, the living from the dead, the eternal from the temporal. Only the symbolist has developed that fine faculty of dividing the relevant from the irrelevant, and prudently preserving that which is usable. As the archaeologist sifting the ashes of dead civilization recovers therefrom priceless evidence of things no longer evident, so the symbolist, studiously examining the intellectual remains of vanished orders, rescues from oblivion those fragments of rationality which will contribute to the right thinking of the world. As the earth is built up of geologic strata, the rod of millennium, so the body of world thought is composed of an infinite number of layers, in each of which may be seen the half-disintegrated remains of vast institutions and noble intellectual procedures. In things of the mind, the past has not lived in vain. Those who live best today live by the world's first thoughts, and the foolish of today still commit the same grave errors that the first philosophers decried. There is no such thing as modernism in human thought, for minds have labored since the beginning, and the world's first thinker reasoned out the same problems which the world's last sage must ponder. The future will